sugars and condiments to more blatant offenders like soft drinks. Even when we try our best to avoid these simple sources of carbohydrates, they can be hidden most inconspicuously. Anti-obesity researcher and crusader Robert Lustig has identified 56 unique terms food manufacturers use to disguise sugar, making it difficult, if not altogether impossible, to spot added sugar on ingredients lists unless you are the most diligent of sleuths. Here are just a few of the many names for sugar. Cane juice, fructose, malt, dextrose, honey, maple syrup, molasses, sucrose, coconut sugar, brown rice syrup, fruit juice, lactose, date sugar, glucose solids, agave syrup, barley malt, maltodextrin, and corn syrup. But it's not just overt forms of sugar that have achieved prominence in the modern diet. Grains like wheat, corn, and rice, tubers like potatoes, and modern sweet fruits are all cultivated for maximum yield of starch and sugar. Though these starches don't look or taste like sugar, they are simply chains of glucose, stored in energy-dense tissue in the seeds of plants. At this point, you may be wondering if this book is going to banish these forms of food from your life forever, and the answer is no. In later chapters, we'll demonstrate how to consume starchy foods with higher energy density in a way that benefits you as opposed to making you fat and sick. Scientists believe that in the pre-agricultural past, we were consuming close to 150 grams of fiber a day. Today, we're eating more concentrated carbohydrates than ever before and getting a meager 15 grams of fiber on a good day. Critics of the ancestral diet often point to the probable consumption of ancient grains in the pre-agricultural diet, but regardless of the exact percentage, they were clearly accompanied by massive fiber content, a dramatic and critically important contrast to the calorie-dense, processed sources we have today. It's important to be aware of the ease with which our bodies can break a starch into its constituent sugar molecules. This conversion process doesn't even wait for you to swallow. It begins in your mouth, thanks to an enzyme in saliva called amylase. If you're like me, you learn this in your ninth grade biology class. Allow a starch to linger in your mouth and you'll taste the sweetness as the starches begin to break down to their constituent sugars right on your tongue. In fact, before you even take your first bite or sip of food, just looking at what you're going to eat stimulates the production of the storage hormone insulin so that it can be ready to dispose of the oncoming sugar deluge. Insulin's main job is to quickly shuttle sugar molecules out of your blood and into your fat and muscle tissue. By the time sugar makes a quick pit stop in your stomach and hops on the 10-minute subway ride to your bloodstream, your body's endocrine or hormone system is already in full-on energy storage mode. But energy storage is just one part of the story. This process is also responsible for controlling the damage caused by having too much sugar in your blood. The human body likes stability. It goes to great lengths to keep your body temperature within a narrow range, hovering around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit at all times. And the same can be said for your blood sugar levels. Your entire circulating plasma volume, about 5 liters of blood, contains just one single teaspoon of sugar at any given time. This may cause you to look at your food in a different light, perhaps thinking twice before reaching for that glass of orange juice, which contains 6 times your body's circulating blood sugar, in just a single cup. Or that delicious cranberry muffin beckoning you from the office kitchen, containing 17 times the amount of sugar dumped nearly instantly into your bloodstream upon consumption. Okay, so what? Eat the sugar, insulin gets it out of the bloodstream. No harm, no foul, right? Wrong. The rising tide of sweet stickiness. Sugar is sticky once it's in your body, akin to the stickiness of maple syrup on your fingers, with the important difference that once sugar sticks to your insides, it can't be washed off. On a molecular level, this is called glycation, and it occurs when a glucose molecule bonds to a nearby protein or the surface of a cell, thereby causing damage. Proteins are required for the proper structure and function of all organs and tissues in your body, from your liver to your skin to your brain. Any food that elevates blood sugar has the potential to increase glycation, and any protein exposed to glucose is vulnerable. Frequently asked question: should I eat brown rice or white rice? Answer: The healthiness of grains typically has been assessed with a metric called the glycemic index. This is a measure of how quickly the food will affect your blood sugar, but is a minimally useful measure of food quality since it doesn't reflect a typical serving size. Also, when sugars and starches are mixed with other foods, the glycemic index becomes inaccurate as fat, protein, and fiber delay the absorption of sugar into the bloodstream. A mixed meal of carbs, protein, and fat might actually be even more difficult for your body to deal with than sugar in its isolated form by prolonging the elevation of insulin. This, over time, can lead to big problems. More on this in the next chapter. Total glycemic load, which takes into account serving size, may be a better measure of meal quality than the glycemic index of any given food. More difficult to measure, but possibly even better, would be total insulin load, which takes into account the potentiation of fat storage that comes with carbs plus fat in processed food. Needless to say, stick to carbs that occur naturally in high-fiber foods like vegetables, low-sugar fruits, I'll list a few shortly, tubers, and beans and legumes, which have a low glycemic index and load. When it comes to rice, just pick the one you prefer. While brown rice contains more fiber and micronutrients than white rice, it's not a great source of either and can be difficult to digest for some people. Given the virtually identical glycemic indexes and loads, when we occasionally hit the sushi bar after an intense exercise session, I go for brown rice while Dr. Paul opts for white and insists that he's made the better tasting choice for an hour afterward. Now that you know how easily starches can be converted to sugar, you should be aware that whether you consume a cup of juice, which leads to a sharp spike in blood sugar, or a bowl of brown rice, which contains fiber and sugars linked together in long chemical chains leading to a smaller but prolonged flood, the amount of glycation that occurs for a given amount of carbs is pretty much the same. This rate can be boiled down to a simple formula. Glycation equals glucose exposure times time. Like oxidation, some degree of glycation is going to occur as an inevitable part of life. But the good news is that, just as we can slow the rate of oxidation in our bodies by avoiding oxidized oils, among other things, we can also slow the rate at which glycation occurs. And our most powerful anti-glycation weapon may just be our forks, which we can use to select foods that do not contain an overabundance of sugar, chained together or otherwise, that can stick to our proteins. Footnote. There is clear person-to-person variation of the impact that a carbohydrate meal, say a whole grain bagel, will have on one's blood sugar. Someone with healthy glucose control might eat a baked potato and see their blood sugar return to baseline soon after, with minimal damage done. Conversely, a person with poor glucose control, somebody with insulin resistance, prediabetes, or type 2 diabetes, might see their blood sugar stay elevated for hours afterward. These factors are mediated by a range of factors, including inflammation, sleep, genes, stress, and even time of day. Here's a list of some sugar-rich foods and some sugar-poor foods. Sugar-rich. Wheat. Whole and white. Oats. Potatoes. Corn. Rice, brown and white. Soft drinks. Cereal. Fruit juice. Sugar-poor. Grass-fed beef. Almonds, avocado, fatty fish, poultry, kale, spinach, eggs. One of the most damaging aspects of glycation is that it leads to the formation of what are called advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, a very appropriate acronym. AGEs are known as gerontotoxins, or aging toxins, from the Greek word geros, meaning old age, and are highly reactive, like biological thugs. They are strongly associated with inflammation and oxidative stress in the body, and they're generated in all people across all ages and to varying degrees, but dictated by and large by diet. Because AGE formation is more or less proportional to blood glucose levels, this process is dramatically accelerated in type 2 diabetics, playing a major role in their tendency toward the development or worsening of degenerative diseases like atherosclerosis and Alzheimer's disease. Speaking of Alzheimer's disease, a brain affected by the disease is riddled with these aging toxins, containing three times the amount of AGEs as in the normal brain. Dutch neurobiologist D.F. Swab, in his book We Are Our Brains, actually described the disease as a premature, accelerated, and severe form of brain aging. Glycation clearly plays a role in this process, and this explains partly why elevated blood sugar increases the risk of dementia, even among non-diabetics. But you don't need to have dementia to suffer the effects of AGEs on your cognition. Non-demented adults free of type 2 diabetes with higher levels of AGEs appeared to show an accelerated loss of cognitive function over time, impaired learning and memory, and reduced expression of genes that promote neuroplasticity and longevity. To get a sense of the rate at which AGEs are being formed in your body, doctors can use a test typically used to manage diabetes called the hemoglobin A1C, which looks at the amount of sugar stuck to red blood cells. Blood cells are in circulation for an average of 4 months, facing constant exposure to the varying levels of sugar in your blood before getting sent off to retirement in your spleen. The A1C therefore paints a picture of your average blood sugar over the last 3 months or so, and may be a powerful marker of risk for cognitive decline or even diminished cognitive performance. In late 2015, I had the opportunity to visit Charity Hospital in Berlin, one of Germany's most research-intensive medical institutions and home of a study that examined the relationship between blood sugar and memory function. The study's lead author, Dr. Agnes Flohl, examined 141 people with A1Cs that were within the range of normal. She found that for every 0.6% increase in a subject's hemoglobin A1C, again a measure of average blood sugar over 3 months, two fewer words were recalled on a verbal memory test. That these subjects were non-diabetic, nor even pre-diabetic, is a startling finding. What's more, people with higher A1Cs also had less volume in the hippocampus, which is the brain's precious memory processing center. Findings published in Neurology, the official journal of the American Academy of Neurology, also indicated that higher fasting blood sugar levels within the range of normal were more likely to predict a loss of volume in that brain region. Doctor's note, the drawbacks of the A1C. The A1C is not a perfect test, but it reaffirms how damaging sugar can be. Research has shown that elevated blood sugar actually shortens the lifespans of blood cells. So while a person with normal blood sugar may have blood cells that live for 4 months, someone with chronically high blood sugar may have blood cells that live for 3 or less. The more time spent in circulation, the more sugar a blood cell may accumulate. A person with truly healthy blood sugar might therefore have the false positive of an elevated A1C, while a diabetic may in actuality have even higher blood sugar than the A1C reveals. In my clinic, I occasionally use a test called fructosamine, which measures compounds that result from glycation and is a reflection of blood sugar control over the previous 2 to 3 weeks, rather than 3 months. Unaffected by the varying lifespans of red blood cells, this test can be useful to analyze a discrepancy with the A1C, i.e. when average blood sugar is changing rapidly due to dietary adjustment. Unfortunately, the damage caused by glycation is not confined to the brain. Glycation is known to promote aging of the skin, liver, kidneys, heart, and bones. No part of us is immune. In a sense, your A1C being directly reflective of both insulin release and AGE formation may even indicate the rate at which you're aging. The eyes are a window to another example of glycation-caused aging, as they contain neurons and other cell types highly vulnerable to glycation. Cataracts are a clouding of the lens of the eye and are the principal cause of blindness worldwide. Scientists know that cataracts can be created in as little as 90 days in lab animals simply by keeping their blood sugar high, thereby accelerating glycation. This perhaps explains why diabetics, who have increased rates of glycation, have up to a 5-fold increased risk for developing cataracts compared to those with normal blood sugar levels. Not all AGEs are made in the body, however. Some come from our environment. Cigarette smoke, for example, is a rich vehicle for these aging accelerators to enter the body. AGE formation is also a fairly common chemical reaction in food preparation, particularly when high-heat cooking methods are used. While AGE research is still in its infancy, studies have shown that the vast majority of AGEs are created endogenously, in the body, and are a result of diets rich in carbohydrates. In fact, vegetarians have been reported to have more circulating AGEs than people who eat meat, and it's thought that the reason for this is their higher reliance on dietary carbohydrates and a greater intake of fruit. Aging toxins in our environment. If you've ever seared a steak on a grill and watched a brown crust develop, you've seen glycation at work. Browning indicates the formation of exogenous, formed outside the body, AGEs. This is known as the Maillard reaction. In truth, the processing of food of any kind creates AGEs, but dry, high-heat methods of cooking like barbecuing or roasting are particularly promotive of AGE formation. And processed meats, sausages and hot dogs, for example, contain a higher amount than their more natural forms. The safest cooking style involves moist heat, such as sautéing or steaming. Plants will contain fewer AGEs than meat, regardless of cooking style. This may cause some to wonder if they should skip the meat altogether, but judging the health quality of a food strictly by its AGE content would be a mistake. Broiled wild salmon, for example, contains a considerable amount of AGEs, and yet wild fish consumption has been associated with healthy cognitive and cardiovascular aging in many studies and trials. Additionally, many anthropologists believe that it wasn't just the consumption of meat, but the very act of cooking it, that helped our ancestors to extract more calories and nutrients from their food, allowing our brains to reach their robust modern size. The safest way to integrate meat products into your diet is to consume cuts that are organic and grass-fed, or wild if we're talking fish, which will ensure higher amounts of antioxidants, and to use as little heat as possible, though of course you'll need to cook food thoroughly enough to avoid illness. It's also important to bear in mind that only between 10 and 30% of exogenous AGEs get absorbed into your body. Antioxidant nutrients like polyphenols and fiber, which are abundant in plant foods, can also neutralize these aging toxins before they're able to make it into your system. If you'd like to treat yourself to roasted chicken, a fairly rich source of AGEs, for example, opting for a heaping plate of dark leafy greens on the side might help minimize the impact. This also helps broker a more pleasant interaction between those AGEs and the trillions of bacteria that reside in your gut, important players in your brain function, as you'll see. Added sugar, the brain bane. Added sugar has become one of the worst evils in our modern food supply. Intended by nature to be consumed in small amounts via whole fruit, where it's packaged with fiber, water, and nutrients, sugar has become the pervasive addition to countless packaged foods and sweetened beverages. Now, finally, nutrition labels in the United States are mandated to list the amount of sugar added to products. Definitely not a cure-all, but a move in the right direction. Whether the sugar is single-origin organic cane sugar, brown rice syrup, or the industry darling high-fructose corn syrup, or HFCS, one thing is clear. The safest level of added sugar consumption is zero. One of the dangers of sugar consumption is that it can hijack our brain's pleasure centers. Packaged food with added sugar usually tastes impossibly delicious and cause massive spikes of dopamine, a neurotransmitter involved in reward. Unfortunately, the more we consume, the more we require to reach the same threshold of pleasure. Sound familiar? It should. Sugar, in the way it stimulates the release of dopamine, resembles drugs of abuse. In fact, in animal models, rats prefer sugar over cocaine, and rats really like cocaine. To borrow a term from Sigmund Freud, rodents are all id, meaning they give in to their cravings. They don't have responsibilities, at least in the human sense, and they certainly don't have to worry about looking good in bathing suits. This is why rat studies are an important part of understanding how food, and in particular sugar, affects our behavior. From rats, we've learned, for example, that fructose in particular may promote its own consumption. When rats were fed the same number of calories from either fructose or glucose, glucose, like potato starch, induced satiety, a feeling of fullness. Fructose, on the other hand, actually provoked more feeding. It somehow made the rats hungrier. The lesson to be inferred is that sugar, and perhaps especially fructose, may actually be causing you to overeat. More on this later. These insights are crucial because we tend to feel guilty when we go through an entire bag of chips or pint of ice cream or box of cookies. Been there? Me too. What nobody tells us as we peruse the aisles lined with air-pumped bags of bliss is that these foods are literally engineered to create insatiable overconsumption, designed in labs by well-paid food scientists to be hyper-palatable. Salt, sugar, fat, and often wheat flour are combined to maximize pleasure, driving your brain's reward system to an artificial bliss point that simulates the addictive properties of controlled substances. Remember the famous slogan, "Once you pop, you can't stop"? It's now a truism with scientific backing. Foods uniquely designed to screw up your brain. Bagels, biscuits, cake, cereal, milk chocolate, white chocolate, cookies, energy bars, crackers, donuts, muffins, pastas, pastries, pies, granola bars, pizza, pretzels, waffles, pancakes, white bread, milkshakes, frozen yogurt, ice cream, batter, gravy, jams, jellies, fries, chips, granola. Don't get fucked over by fructose. Beelzebub, Satan, Abaddon, Lucifer, the evil one. Like the devil, sugar takes many forms and goes by many names. Sucrose, dextrose, glucose, maltose, lactose. What's the difference, and why should you care? They can all spike your blood sugar and tamper with the hormones that control appetite and fat storage. However, one in particular has gotten the spotlight recently, and perhaps for good reason, as it has silently crept its way into every crevice of our food environment. Fructose. Frequently asked question. Now that my favorite soft drink is made with real, organic, non-GMO sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup, that means it's healthier, right? Answer. No. Table sugar, organic or not, and high fructose corn syrup are both roughly 50% glucose and 50% fructose. Both are pure sugar, and both can lead to the same problems: addiction, fat storage, and accelerated glycation. Fructose is processed differently than glucose, bypassing your bloodstream and hopping on the express train to your liver. Dr. Lustig calls the unique effect of fructose on our biology isocaloric but not isometabolic. The iso prefix signifies same. What this means is that though it has an equal number of calories gram for gram as other sugars, fructose seems to behave in a rather peculiar manner from the perspective of your metabolism. It doesn't elevate blood sugar and doesn't cause a rise in insulin, at least not initially. Food companies commonly exploit this difference to sell products sweetened with fructose to health-conscious consumers and diabetics. Once inside the liver, fructose induces lipogenesis, literally fat creation. In truth, all carbohydrates when consumed in excess are capable of stimulating lipogenesis, but fructose may be the most efficient at doing so. One short-term study published in the journal Obesity demonstrated nearly double the increase in liver fat when healthy humans on high-calorie diets supplemented with fructose compared to glucose, 113% versus 59% respectively. After fructose fills your liver to its capacity with fat, it spills over into your bloodstream as triglycerides. Consuming fat also leads to a short post-meal triglyceride spike, but lipogenesis due to fructose consumption can dump more fat into your blood than even the highest fat-containing meal. Following a high fructose snack, your blood can actually take on the appearance of pink cream for this very reason. This is also why fasting triglyceride levels, a marker used to assess metabolic health and heart disease risk, are nearly universally influenced by carbohydrate consumption, and by fructose in particular. While fructose has a negligible immediate effect on blood sugar, frequent consumption will eventually cause blood sugar to rise because the stress on the liver creates inflammation, impairing the ability of cells to suck up glucose from the blood. This may have been an adaptation to help us store more fat when fruit was in season, and yet now explains why sugar consumption dovetails with skyrocketing rates of type 2 diabetes. Now is probably a good time to question whether fructose-dominant sweeteners like agave syrup, 90% fructose, are really the right choice for health-conscious individuals or diabetics. The combined effects of fructose may add up to altered gene expression in the brain. In a study out of UCLA, rats were given the amount of fructose equivalent to drinking a 1-liter bottle of soda every day. After 6 weeks, they began to show typical derangements. They had escalating levels of blood sugar, triglycerides, and insulin, and their cognition began to break down. Compared to mice fed only water, the fructose-drinking mice took double the time to find their way out of a maze. But what surprised researchers most was that close to 1,000 genes in the brains of the fructose-fed rats were altered. These weren't genes for cute pink noses and fuzzy whiskers. They were comparable to genes in humans, having links to Parkinson's disease, depression, bipolar disorder, and others. The degree of gene disruption was so profound, head researcher Fernando Gomez Pinilla commented in the UCLA release, "Food is like a pharmaceutical compound in terms of its effect on the brain." But that power also swings in the other direction. The negative impact that fructose had on both cognition and gene expression was attenuated by feeding the rats DHA omega-3 fat. Avoiding the stresses imposed on the brain by excess sugar consumption may be an empowering leverage point for the 5.3 million Americans suffering from traumatic brain injury. A diet high in fructose impaired the plasticity of rat brains, diminishing their ability to heal after head trauma. Though rats are not people, brain injury is a fairly organic condition that is easily replicable in animals, unlike, say, a complex human disease that rats and mice do not naturally develop. Human foie gras. Fructose and sugar consumption in general is a major contributor to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD. Currently affecting 70 million adults in the United States, 30% of the population, rates of NAFLD are expected to explode in the coming years unless we can do something about our collective sweet tooth. By the year 2030, it's estimated that 50% of the U.S. population will have NAFLD, and insulin resistance, a problem affecting a staggering number of people worldwide, is directly proportional to the severity of the disease. But we're not the only animals experiencing an epidemic of fatty livers. Similar to humans, but on a much larger scale, ducks and geese are able to store a massive surplus of calories in their livers in the form of fat. This is an adaptation that allows them to fly long distances without stopping for food, and it is exploited to create foie gras, a French delicacy that is enjoyed by many around the world. Foie gras is a well-fattened duck or goose liver and is revered for its rich, buttery texture, something this type of liver is not typically known for. To make it, tubes are inserted into the throats of healthy geese and ducks, and they are force-fed grain, usually corn. With the animals eventually consuming far more carbohydrates than they ever would in a natural setting, the livers swell with fat, growing to nearly 10 times their normal size. The swelling can be so severe that it impairs blood flow and increases abdominal pressure, hindering the animal's ability to breathe. Sometimes the liver and other organs will even rupture from the stress. Cruel and inhumane, it provides an excellent, if extreme, illustration of exactly what we're doing to ourselves as a consequence of chronic sugar consumption, developing fat-filled livers and creating foie gras right inside of our own bodies. Save for a dinner date with Hannibal Lecter, you're unlikely to be poached for pâté, but harboring a disgruntled liver can nonetheless produce many undesirable consequences, as the organ is tasked with hundreds of important functions in the body. NAFLD has been associated with cognitive deficits, which increase with the severity of the disease. In mice that are overfed to develop NAFLD, brain changes associated with Alzheimer's disease begin to emerge, and mice that already had Alzheimer's-related abnormalities, not a perfect model of human Alzheimer's, but interesting nonetheless, exhibit exacerbated signs of disease and greater inflammation when fed concentrated fructose. While 70 to 80% of obese individuals have NAFLD, so do 10 to 15% of normal weight individuals, fed by the ubiquity of sugar and fructose. As you can see, being thin does not make you impervious to the metabolic and cognitive effects of a poor diet. A gut-brain terrorist. Unsurprisingly, ground zero for many of the problems associated with sugar is the gut. Fructose in particular, whether from processed sugary foods or excessive fruit sugar, impairs its own absorption when it is consumed in large amounts. While this may sound vaguely positive, the excess fructose left to linger in the gut can create many unpleasant symptoms, from bloating and cramps to diarrhea and symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS. As gnarly as this sounds, high intestinal fructose concentration can also interfere with tryptophan absorption. Tryptophan is an essential amino acid that we must get from our diets, and it is the direct precursor to the neurotransmitter serotonin, which is important for healthy mood and executive function. This may be why fructose malabsorption is associated with symptoms of depression. The gut lining is the precious matrix across which we absorb nutrients from food. It also helps keep intestinal bacteria in the gut where it belongs. The last thing you'd want to do is poke holes in your gut lining, but this is what concentrated fructose seems to be able to do. The technical term for this is increased intestinal permeability, which is when the gut lining allows the leakage of inflammatory bacterial components from the gut into circulation. The seepage of these bacterial components into your blood is a major driver of systemic inflammation, and it can induce symptoms of depression and anxiety as it switches the immune system of your brain and body into high alert. This phenomenon is covered in greater depth in Chapter 7. While high concentrations of fructose from processed foods have been shown to contribute to gut permeability, this does not seem to happen when small amounts of fructose are consumed in whole, fresh fruit. This is thanks in part to the fibrous matrix that the sugars are bound in, water, and other phytonutrients. Whole fruit consumption is also self-limiting because the fiber makes it more filling. For example, it would be quite difficult to eat 5 apples, but it's a breeze to drink the sugar contained in 5 apples when juiced. Plaque on your teeth and in your brain. A high-sugar diet might not just put plaque on your teeth, it may deposit it in your brain as well. In an attempt to find out whether blood sugar might increase the production of amyloid plaque, a central feature of Alzheimer's disease, researchers attached glucose clamps to mice that were genetically engineered to develop Alzheimer's-like symptoms. Glucose clamps provide ports that allow scientists to increase or decrease blood sugar levels in awake, freely moving animals to see what effect such tinkering has on their bodies, brains, and behavior. The researchers then measured levels of amyloid plaque's precursor protein in the animal's spinal fluid. What researchers found was fascinating. Just by temporarily dialing up the amount of sugar in the mice's blood, amyloid production dramatically increased. Young mice that had their blood sugar doubled during a 4-hour challenge, the equivalent of eating a high-carbohydrate meal by a person with poor glucose control, had a 25% increase in amyloid beta production as measured in their spinal fluid. Older mice were particularly vulnerable, seeing a 40% increase from the same blood sugar challenge. Researchers noted that repeated surges of blood sugar, such as what is common in type 2 diabetes, could both initiate and accelerate plaque accumulation. They concluded that plaques in the hippocampus are likely modulated by blood glucose levels. The important distinction, of course, is that what happens in rodent disease models doesn't always happen in humans. Regardless, studies like this are important pieces in the puzzle for discovering why higher glucose levels are strongly associated with increased risk for dementia, even in people without diabetes. The sour truth about sweet fruit. Why would a sugar found naturally in fruit be so poorly tolerated by modern humans? It doesn't make intuitive sense until we consider the scarcity and seasonality of fruit until a few short decades ago. Like the casino of a Las Vegas resort, our modern food complex has lost any sense of time, place, and season. Within a single generation, we have gained unprecedented access to sweet fruit. A pineapple from the tropics, berries grown in Mexico, and medjool dates from Morocco are now flown to our towns and cities so that they may line our supermarket shelves all year long. These fruits are bred to be larger and contain more sugar than ever before in history. We are frequently told that it's okay, beneficial even, to consume unlimited fruit. But looked at through an evolutionary lens, fruit, and particularly today's cultivated high-sugar versions, may be uniquely adept at tricking our body's metabolisms. This is theorized to be an adaptive, temporary quality that helped us pack away fat so that we might survive the winter. In fact, it's thought that our ancestors developed red-green color vision for the sole purpose of distinguishing a ripe red fruit from a green background, an evolutionary testament to the life-saving value of fruit for a hungry forager. Today, 365 days of high-sugar fruit consumption is readying our bodies for a winter that never seems to come. What consequences of gorging on grapes and other sweet fruit could there possibly be for our brains? A few large studies have helped to shed some light. In one, higher fruit intake in older, cognitively healthy adults was linked with less volume in the hippocampus. This finding was unusual, since people who eat more fruit usually display the benefits associated with a healthy diet. In this study, however, the researchers isolated various components of the subjects' diets and found that fruit didn't seem to be doing their memory centers any favors. Another study from the Mayo Clinic saw a similar inverse relationship between fruit intake and the volume of the cortex, the larger outer layer of the brain. Researchers in the latter study noted that excessive consumption of high-sugar fruit, such as figs, dates, mango, banana, and pineapple, may induce metabolic and cognitive derangements on par with processed carbs. Doctor's note: when you really need to restrict fruit. People have a wide tolerance for carbohydrates, but for diabetics, it's pretty much open and shut that sugar, even from fruit, needs to be dramatically restricted. I have my diabetic patients consume fruit in half-serving quantities. Even a single orange can spike the blood sugar into an unacceptable range for hours after eating it. But all is not without hope. Once insulin sensitivity is restored, exercise has become a habit, and the system has had time to restore energy balance and metabolic flexibility, unprocessed carb sources can be reintroduced. Fruits, however, do contain various important nutrients. Luckily, low-sugar fruits are among the most concentrated sources of these nutrients. Some examples include coconut, avocado, olives, and cacao. No, this does not mean that chocolate is a fruit, but dark chocolate does have a myriad of brain benefits and is one of our genius foods. Berries are also great because not only are they low in fructose, but they are particularly high in certain antioxidants shown to have a memory-boosting and anti-aging effect. The Nurses' Health Study, a long-running dietary survey of 120,000 female nurses, found that those who ate the most berries had brains that looked 2.5 years younger on scans. In fact, while a recent analysis of the literature found no association between overall fruit intake and reduced dementia risk, berry consumption was the sole exception. Very nice! A call to action. Every year, billions of dollars are spent to market junk foods to the American people. But more than simply buying ad space in magazines or on TV, these juggernaut companies regularly fund studies to downplay the role of junk food in the public obesity crisis. The New York Times recently exposed scientists involved in a leading soda giant's initiative to shift the focus in the global obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemics from diet to laziness and lack of exercise. An executive of the group was quoted as saying, "Most of the focus in the popular media and in the scientific press is, oh, they're eating too much, eating too much, eating too much, blaming fast food, blaming sugary drinks, and so on. And there's really virtually no compelling evidence that that, in fact, is the cause." While exercise is vital to the health of the brain and body, study after study has shown it to be only minimally impactful on weight compared with what people consume. Fitness enthusiasts know that abs are made in the kitchen, but for many of those who are overweight and obese, a statement like the above only perpetuates the confusion. This sets up a trap for society's most vulnerable, paving the way for cognitive dysfunction and an early death. This is not an exaggeration. For the first time, our eating habits are killing more Americans than our smoking habits. In fact, the latest figures published in the journal Circulation suggest that nearly 200,000 people die each year from diseases driven by sugar-sweetened beverages alone. That is 7 times the number of people killed by global terrorism in 2015. And speaking of smoking, let's look for a second to the historical awareness of the link between cigarettes and lung cancer. It took decades for enough proof to show up in the medical literature to convince physicians that cigarettes were a major driver of soaring lung cancer rates, even though the disease had been very rare prior to the ubiquity of smoking in the mid-20th century. And who can forget the cringeworthy ads from the 1940s, easily Googleable, featuring doctors blatantly endorsing cigarettes? As recently as the 1960s, 2/3 of all U.S. doctors believed the case against cigarettes hadn't yet been established, despite smoking being recognized as a leading cause of the lung cancer epidemic 2 decades prior. Should we wait for the scientific consensus to rethink our consumption of something mired in profit, something for which there is not only no human need, but which data indicates is almost certainly causing us harm? Keep your answer in mind as we venture into one of the great cons of our time in the next chapter. Field notes. Sugar-protein bonding, or glycation, can occur to any protein in the presence of sugar. All carbohydrates, with the exception of fiber, have the potential to glycate. While end products of glycation, AGEs, may be consumed in food, the vast majority are formed in your body as a result of chronic carbohydrate consumption. Isolated fructose creates stress on the liver, which promotes inflammation and insulin resistance. Sugar interacts with genes in the brain, reducing neuroplasticity and impairing cognitive function. Certain foods are created to be hyperpalatable, leading to insatiable hunger and overconsumption. These foods are essentially bear traps of inflammation and obesity and are best avoided completely. Industry does not care about your health. Don't wait for scientific consensus before banishing unnecessary and potentially harmful substances from your diet. Genius food number 3, blueberries. Of all commonly consumed fruits and vegetables, blueberries are among the highest in antioxidant capacity because of their abundance of compounds called flavonoids. Flavonoids are a class of polyphenol compounds that are found in many of the genius foods. You may remember oleocanthal and extra virgin olive oil, which is a type of phenol. The most abundant flavonoids in blueberries are anthocyanins, which have been shown to cross the blood-brain barrier, enhancing signaling in parts of the brain that handle memory. Astonishingly, these beneficial anthocyanins accumulate in the brain's hippocampus. My friend Robert Krikorian, the director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the University of Cincinnati Academic Health Center, is one of the foremost researchers looking into the effects of blueberries on memory function in humans. Dr. Krikorian has published research showing a robust benefit to cognitive function with blueberry consumption. In one such example, 12 weeks of blueberry supplementation improved memory function and mood and reduced fasting blood sugar in older adults at risk for dementia. Observational research is just as compelling. A 6-year study of 16,010 older adults found that consumption of blueberries and strawberries was linked to delays in cognitive aging by up to 2.5 years. And while a recent review found no association between general fruit intake and dementia risk in humans, berries were found to be associated. They protected the brain against cognitive loss. How to buy and consume. Fresh blueberries are great, but don't be afraid to buy frozen blueberries, which are often much cheaper and more widely available than fresh. Always opt for organic. Blueberries are great in smoothies and salads or eaten as a snack. Pro tip. All berries are likely helpful to the brain, though they vary in terms of the specific beneficial compounds found in each. When you want to mix things up, blackberries, bilberries, raspberries, and strawberries may be used in place of blueberries. Chapter 4. Winter is coming for your brain. It's easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled. Unknown. This is a story about a jilted lover. After reading the last chapter, it may strain credulity for you to learn that I've had a lifelong love affair with carbohydrates. But it's true. If I had to close my eyes and think of life's greatest pleasures, chomping down on a freshly baked red velvet cupcake would be up there. Let's be honest, though. Not everything that we love is good for us. It doesn't take a nutrition degree to realize that confectionery bakery products are usually loaded with sugar and refined white flour. Even the young me knew to stay away from the obvious offenders and gravitate toward healthy grains instead, especially nutty, chewy, whole ones. Despite growing up mostly around white flour in the form of bagels, pasta, and black and white cookies, a childhood favorite, I sensed from early on that the less processed grains were, the better they would be for me. Not yet a teenager, I became a lobbyist within my own family, advocating for products with the red Heart Healthy logo on them when I'd helped my mom shop for groceries. They were earthier and had more stuff in them, like bran, which I believed gave them more bang for the nutritional buck. I even had a favorite bread growing up called Health Nut, the name of which reassured me as if every slice eaten was another brick laid on the road to health for me and my family. I carried this appreciation for grains with me into my adult life, and as I became more proactive about healthy eating, I thought, as many do, more grains equal more health. My day would often look like this. In the morning, I'd have a big bowl of granola with fat-free milk or a whole wheat bagel and a piece of fruit. By lunch, I'd usually find myself starving, grabbing a sandwich or wrap, only on whole wheat, or my favorite, a brown rice bowl. Post-lunch comas became a common phenomenon, and as a result, I'd need to have a few snacks to keep my blood sugar up in between lunch and dinner, usually a cookie or two, a few whole wheat crackers, or some dried fruit. I didn't have an understanding of the dynamics of blood sugar that I do now, and that you will soon, but I did notice that carbohydrates tended to alleviate the lethargy I was experiencing. My dinner would usually involve more brown rice, but on some nights I'd switch it up and go for a big bowl of whole wheat pasta. If there was one rule I followed, it was that meals always had to include a grain. Even though my energy levels and food cravings often felt like a roller coaster throughout the day, I never thought to question my diet. Why would I? I was in the 1% of grain consumers, eating them nearly exclusively in their whole, unadulterated state. But here's the devastating truth. I was misled about the health quality of grains, and you were too. Origins of a myth. One of the most well-known dietary patterns shown to confer cardioprotective and neuroprotective effects is the Mediterranean diet, first popularized by renowned fat disparager Ansel Keys. You may remember him from such popular hits as Chapter 2. Keys enjoyed vacationing on the Greek island of Crete, a region of exceptionally long-lived people, and he used their diet as the backbone for his studies in human nutrition. If Keys had visited the East, he might instead have singled out the diet of the exceptionally healthy Japanese, rich in fish eggs, fermented soybeans, a dish called natto, and kelp noodles. But Greece and Italy were popular destinations at the time, they were closer and warmer, and certainly had better wine. As he saw it, the people of the Mediterranean built their diets around plant foods and seafood, vegetables, legumes, fish, olive oil, grains, and nuts. But people in the Greek islands also love their meat, and fatty cuts of lamb are regularly enjoyed. This was perhaps lost on Keys, who happened to visit Crete during a particularly lean time, stationing himself on the impoverished island just after World War II, and during Lent, when meat consumption was particularly limited. Nonetheless, Keys' observations became the basis of the grain-based Mediterranean dietary pattern, ultimately informing the development of the highly influential food pyramid, which advised consumers to eat less fat and load up on grain products, up to 11 servings per day. The food pyramid's successor, the USDA MyPlate, still advises consumers to include grains at every meal. Food manufacturers didn't object, taking advantage of hefty grain subsidies. But did Keys attribute the health effects of the Mediterranean diet to the wrong food group? When looking at population data, one might notice that the intake of whole grains is certainly associated with less diabetes, colon cancer, and heart and brain disease. People who consume mostly brown rice, whole wheat bread, and highfalutin grains like quinoa tend to make better choices elsewhere in their diets. They may eat more wild fish rich in omega-3s, extra virgin olive oil, and vegetables, and far fewer of the refined carbs and Franken oils that are characteristic of the Western diet. They also live healthier lifestyles in general and tend to exercise more. But at this bird's eye view, it's impossible to isolate the health effects of grains in an overall healthy diet. Still, the idea that whole grains improve health has become, for lack of a better term, ingrained. They've even been grandfathered into modern spin-offs of the Mediterranean diet, such as the government-endorsed DASH diet to reduce high blood pressure. In this chapter, as we explore the role of an ancestral hormone called insulin in brain function, we'd like you to don your skeptic's hat, like any good scientist, and consider that the Mediterranean diet is healthy not because of grains, but in spite of them. The problem with chronic carbs. Grains are often considered healthy because of the small amounts of vitamins and fiber that they contain. But grains in their most commonly consumed form spike blood sugar as effectively as table sugar. This occurs because the starch they contain is simply glucose molecules bound together in chains that begin to come apart as soon as you chew them. A major energy precursor in the body, glucose is used to fuel our leg muscles as we ascend a flight of stairs, our brains as we crunch for a test, and our immune systems when we are fighting off a cold. But glucose molecules from a slice of whole wheat bread, for example, can't just waltz into cells. They need an escort. Enter insulin. Insulin is a hormone released into the bloodstream by our pancreas when it senses that blood sugar has become elevated. Insulin activates receptors on the surfaces of cell membranes, which dutifully roll out the equivalent of a red carpet, welcoming sugar molecules inside where they can be stored or converted to energy. When we're healthy, muscle, fat, and liver cells require little insulin to respond, but repeated and prolonged stimulation of insulin receptors will, over time, force the cell to desensitize itself by reducing the number of receptors on the surface. While tolerance in everyday life is a virtue, tolerance to insulin is anything but. Once it occurs, the pancreas has to release more insulin for the same net effect. Meanwhile, blood sugar continues to creep up and stay higher for longer between meals, accelerating the nasty process of sugar-protein bonding, aka glycation. Tolerance or resistance to insulin affects a huge number of people. Newsflash, you might be one of them. Around 1 in 2 people in the United States have blood sugar control issues, including prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. The former now affects a whopping 86 million people in the United States alone. Type 2 diabetes, the most advanced stage of insulin resistance, develops when a flood of insulin is required to accomplish what at one point would have taken a relatively small amount. Eventually, the pancreas poops out, unable to keep up with the demand for ever more insulin, and blood sugar stays high despite maximal insulin release. But what of the other half of the population who are neither pre-diabetic nor diabetic? If your blood sugar is normal, you're all good, right? Unfortunately, even among people with normal blood sugar levels, insulin resistance is startlingly common. Thanks to the work of pathologist Joseph R. Kraft, we now know that abnormal blood sugar is actually a late marker of chronically elevated insulin. As it turns out, chronically elevated insulin can evade routine clinical markers such as fasting blood sugar and the A1C test described in the previous chapter for years, even decades, before detection, all while impairing your memory and setting the stage for future brain problems. Doctor's note, the long road to diabetes. To provide a sense of baseline, the average healthy adult pumps out about 25 units of insulin per day to control blood sugar. Now contrast that to some of my diabetic patients who are injecting upward of 100 to 150 units of insulin per day, more than 5 times the physiological norm. This means that before their diagnoses, their pancreases were working double and triple overtime for many years before their blood sugar started to creep up. Priorities for different time. Insulin is the body's chief anabolic hormone, which means that it creates an environment in your body favorable to growth and storage. This can be useful in shuttling energy in the form of sugar and amino acids into muscle tissue after a 12-hour day of pulling weeds from a field or carrying water from a distant well. But more often than not, these resources end up on our hips and waistlines. To your fat cells, elevated insulin often means one thing, party time. This was helpful, life-saving even, during more austere times. Today, it's causing our bodies to stockpile fat in preparation for a famine that never seems to come. But while being overweight makes it more likely than not that insulin resistance lurks below the surface, chronically elevated insulin is common among people that are thin. This often goes undetected because most people assume that thinness equals metabolic health, a major error. There's even a medical term for normal weight patients with metabolic syndrome, metabolically obese normal weight. The non-medical term is skinny fat. This illustrates an important but often confused point. Insulin resistance and obesity are independent conditions. Yes, it is possible to fit into small sizes and still be obese on the inside. One consequence of elevated insulin for the thin and overweight alike is that the release of stored fat for fuel, a process called lipolysis, is blocked. How? Insulin acts like a one-way valve on your fat cells. This means that when insulin is elevated, calories can go in, but they can't come out. Your fat cells become a roach motel, meant as a way of increasing and preserving stored fuels when the body senses that food is abundant. Imagine the average person consuming more than 300 grams of carbohydrate per day, mostly from refined sources like toaster pastries, commercial breads, sugar-sweetened beverages, and wheat snacks. For this person, insulin production is constant. This presents a major problem because certain organs have evolved to use and even prefer fat for fuel, such as nerve cells of the eye and the heart muscle, but are prevented from doing so. New research has shown that, contrary to what was previously believed, fat can be used as a source of energy for the photoreceptors of the eye. Published in Nature Medicine, researchers demonstrated how starving these cells of fatty acids could drive age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, suggesting that AMD may in fact be a form of diabetes of the eye. In light of insulin's role in suppressing fatty acid release, reducing carbohydrate intake and thus insulin secretion could provide a meaningful and safe lifestyle modification for a substantial at-risk population. AMD remains the leading cause of visual impairment in Westerners over the age of 50. Even the brain can use fat for fuel once fat is broken down into chemicals called ketone bodies. Ketone bodies, or simply ketones, become elevated with periods of fasting, very low carbohydrate diets, and by consuming certain ketone-producing foods. They're also produced during vigorous exercise once glucose stores have become exhausted. But ketones aren't just a fuel. They also act as a signaling molecule, flipping switches in the brain that seem to have a range of beneficial effects. Among them is the ability to boost BDNF, the brain's ultimate neuroprotective protein. However, chronically elevated insulin keeps us metabolically inflexible by blocking ketones from being generated. The inhibition of lipid or fat metabolism by high-carbohydrate diets may be the most detrimental aspect of modern diets, opines Sam Henderson, a well-known researcher in the area of ketones and Alzheimer's disease. You'll learn more about ketones and all of their therapeutic and performance-boosting potential in Chapter 6. The key to allowing these fatty acids to come out and play is reducing insulin, plain and simple. Italian researcher Cherubino Di Lorenzo, who actually studies the effects of ketones on migraine headaches, perhaps said it best. You could think of this fat-mobilizing process as the body's own biochemical liposuction. You age at the rate you produce insulin. Almost any dieter will benefit from an initial period of drastic carbohydrate restriction. In fact, a very low carbohydrate diet will, on average, halve the amount of total insulin secreted by the pancreas and increase a person's insulin sensitivity after just one day. While this is no doubt good news for our beer bellies, muffin tops, and saddlebags, it may also be key to slowing down the aging process. Aside from contributing to adiposity, the scientific word for fatness, chronically elevated insulin is thought to speed up the underlying processes of aging. MIT and Harvard lecturer Josh Middledorf made no bones about it in his book Cracking the Aging Code. Every bowl of pasta sends a message to the body to put on body fat and accelerate the aging process. During a caloric surplus easily enabled with hyperpalatable carbohydrates, the long-term picture fades from view, and cellular repair projects go on hiatus. After all, why go through the effort of repairing old cells when you could just create new ones from the bounty of available energy? On the other hand, when the body perceives that food is in short supply, gene pathways involved in repairing and restoring become active so that the body will still be healthy come tomorrow when the famine is over. These pathways are like little biological apps hard-coded into our genome that become active in a low-insulin environment. One such longevity pathway is FOXO3, which, among other things, helps to maintain stem cell pools in the body as we age. Stem cells are cool because they're able to differentiate into many different cell types, including neurons, and help to repair against damage incurred during aging. Some scientists believe that if we could top off, or at least slow depletion of, our diminishing stem cell pools as we get older, we'd be able to better defend against the ravages of aging and extend our years spent youthful and healthy. Activating FOXO3 may be one of the most readily accessible ways of doing this. In fact, people with one copy of a gene that makes their FOXO3 more active have double the odds of living to be 100 years old. Those with two copies have triple the odds. The empowering news here is that we can mimic many of these benefits in part by keeping tight reins on our body's production of insulin. We can do this by engaging in brief periods of fasting, which I will introduce in Chapter 6, avoiding rapidly digesting sugars, and demoting starches, especially processed grains, from mainstays in our diets to occasional indulgences. Genius Food Number 9, Wild salmon also contains a compound that stimulates FOXO3. Gumming up the works. You may already be familiar with some of the cognitive consequences of regular insulin spikes. I certainly was. The most obvious symptoms may be the lethargy that you feel soon after a high carbohydrate meal.